Ladies and gentlemen, may I ask you to take your seats? We are about to start, and my name is David Wasserstein, for those, if there are any of you who don't know, and this is the opening of our meeting on Jews among Arabs, the future of their past. I'm not going to say another word at the moment because we don't yet exist as a meeting. We are to be opened formally by the Dean of the College of Arts and Science here, Professor Richard McCarty, who is going to say a few words.
I'm so delighted all of you could come tonight. I guess we're going to have some interesting weather events. I know this was a special effort for many of you, and I think it will be, and now we can truly begin, because Jack Sasson is here. Because I know it will be richly rewarded by our speaker. I'm so pleased because this is, in many ways, a culminating moment by being able to welcome Professor Somek to Vanderbilt personally. And it sort of involves both of our colleagues who have been directors of Jewish studies. And I'm deeply grateful to my colleagues for attracting you here to Vanderbilt for this visit. You honor us by being here. I'd also just like to say how pleased I am with the development of Jewish studies under the able leadership of Jack and David. This has really been a program that has developed in rapid progression, and I think we still have some work to do, but we're clearly on the right track with the people that have come here. I know this meeting has been pulled together somewhat at the last minute, so I'd also like to welcome our visitors and thank all of you for altering your schedules to accommodate this series of talks. I wish I could stay, but if I don't meet my wife in a few minutes, I'll have to find another place to live. I do think it bears mentioning that the topic that you'll be working on is such an important one, and it's so obvious it really begs the question if it needs to be mentioned, but I think it's hard to understand the present if you don't have a full appreciation for the complexities of the past, and we have wonderful people to guide us on this exploration this evening and tomorrow, and I wish you all the very best as you do this. And I thank you, David, for taking the role of leading this effort and bringing all these amazing people together. So I do this a lot, and many times I don't get to stay. I'm feeling impoverished at times because, you know, it's nice to welcome visitors, but it's not so great to be able to rush off and then not take advantage of their many gifts. So, Professor Somek, welcome to Vanderbilt. We're so happy for you to be here, and I look forward to talking to you later in the semester before you depart. Okay? Congratulations.
Thank you very much, Richard. It's very great. We're very, very, very grateful for your presence and very grateful for your words. The reason why we are having this meeting is essentially Sasson Somek. Sasson Somek came here as a visiting professor this semester and has been teaching and working and talking on subjects that really revolve, all of them, around the subject of our meeting, Jews among Arabs. In a way, the title that we chose to give to this meeting comes from Sasson himself. We had great difficulty in choosing a title, but eventually, in conversation with Sasson, the title emerged, Jews Among Arabs, the Future of Their Past. The Future of Their Past was an addition, as you can tell, but Jews Among Arabs, not Jews with Arabs, not Jews and Arabs, not Jews but Arabs, or Arabs but Jews, but Jews Among Arabs. And the reason why that came, I think, is simply that Sasson himself was a Jew among Arabs in his youth, and his latest book, which somebody should have reminded me to bring a copy of to wave at this point. Thank you very much, Sasson. Is about that. Baghdad et Montadara. is Baghdad Etmol, Baghdad Yesterday, his memoirs of growing up in Baghdad in the years of the middle and late 30s and the 1940s before his move to Israel. Jews have been in Iraq since 2,500 years ago, at least, although now there are almost none left. The history of their presence there, the history of the presence of Jews, not just in Iraq, but in Syria, and in Egypt, and in other lands of the Islamic and the Arab dispersion, is a very long and very rich and very varied one. And one of the blessings of having Sasson here for this semester is that we are able to have a meeting which is devoted to a particular aspect, as you will see from our set of aspects, as you will see from the richness on the on the program in front of you or in your pockets. The two aspects in particular are the history of the Jews in Arab lands and the literature of the Jews, particularly in the modern period in Arab lands. These are areas which are much studied but not enough studied, and in particular the latter, we have an area which is not studied enough yet but is becoming to be studied much more. We are having a number of presentations on these themes in the next 24 hours, and I urge you all to come and listen to all of them. Our first presentation today is from Sasson himself, and it is about, I gather, early photographs. It's called On Writing an Autobiography, but he told me the other day that it's really about the photographs in his autobiography, and having seen them, I can imagine that we have a rich treat in store. So let me hand straight over to Sasson.
Thank you, David. And thank you, David, again for initiating this workshop, or whatever we call it, small conference. I'm very pleased to be here. Not just because I'm being honored or something like that, but because this conference will be shared by some of my very best friends. First of all, people whom I got to know during the last 3 months here, some of them became dear friends, and second, the speakers. And Jack is here at long last. I was waiting for him to come. And the main speakers of this conference, with the exception of one speaker, are actually my students in one way or another. The first sparrow just arrived here. She's Professor Orit Bashkin of Chicago University. She's an actual friend of student of mine. I mean, she wrote a paper in the past, but she underway now, on the way to from the hotel here, is another one, Lital Levy of the University, now both of Harvard and Princeton, and Berkeley, if you wish. Unbelievable, right? And she's coming, and she'll be speaking tomorrow. Nancy Berg, who, for reasons of weather, has been delayed. And who else? These are my direct students. I mean, Nancy Berg wrote two, I was in her doctoral committee in Philadelphia. And then she wrote a postdoctoral book about Sami Michael, who just came out under my supervision. She was sent to Israel to work with me. So I'm very pleased to see that. I mean, these are not my only students who have reached a high standing in the profession in Arabic studies and Middle Eastern studies. There are about 10 of them in Israel, and one in Egypt, actually. Now he's head of the Israeli Academic Center, and others. So these are the main reasons that I'm proud of anything. These are my pride. And most of them showed distinction and very good scholarship. Here's Lital just arrived. And also I'd like to thank Lynn for all the efforts she invested in this, preparing this delightful event. Hi, Lital. So I called my talk something like to write an autobiography, and don't worry, I'm not going to try and teach you how to write autobiography, to instruct you in the fine art of autobiography, because I'm not sure that I'm mastered the art myself very well. I'm still thinking how to make it better. Anyhow, yeah, please, everyone, there are pictures at the end which are worth looking at. What I'm going to talk to is for the next half hour, right, David? In a half hour?
Yeah.
Is mainly the circumstances and the motivations behind writing the book. Why I wrote it. And then if I have time, I talk about reactions and responses to the publication of the book. And if I have more time, I'll tell you some secrets of my, in what I'm writing these days. But that's not sure. Anyhow, let's start with the first thing. Why did I write it? Okay, David Wasserstein called this workshop Arabs Among Jews. It's not my invention, it's his. And that's the reason I wrote the book. I'm actually one of the last Arab Jews in the world. A Jew who was born in Arab land, whose mother language, mother tongue was Arabic. He is versed in the literature of the Arabs and the language of the Arabs. I didn't live 2,500 years, as David said, in Baghdad, but I lived 17 years, and that was enough to make me a full-fledged Arab Jew in every way. This is the culture, this is the literature. I grew on the way you read Shakespeare and I don't know, Longfellow, whatever. I read the Mutanabbi and the medieval poets. I learned them by heart. That's what I call, I'm one of the last, because it was the day I left Iraq, was basically the day I finished school. There were no generations behind me who finished high school in Baghdad. I once called myself, when the book came out, and the journalist quoted me saying, I'm the last Arab Jew. And people were very, made fun of me, said, why are you the last? Why do you think you are important? What about the other Arab Jews? Why do you call yourself Arab Jew, etc., etc.? So it was my duty to talk about this. What is the meaning of being an Arab Jew? I mean, the Jews of Iraq were a prosperous community, there were also poor people, but it was a very dynamic community, and they saw good days, they also saw bad days, which I will refer to later, and but we lived among Arabs. Now, there's nothing like that. I mean, no Jew, with the exception of a few thousands in Morocco, I think, who are living in Jews are living in Arab country with neighbor of Arab citizens. Otherwise, my generation is the last generation to practice a kind of neighborhood with Arab Muslims and Christians, also Christians in Iraq. It was incumbent on me to do this thing. Actually, it all happened when, around 1999, when I was teaching at NYU, and several Jews, young Jews in the university, came and asked me, "Why don't you write about this thing? You are a unique bird now. There's nobody after you who can call himself an Arab Jew in this sense." And that gave me the push. I started actually writing in 1999. There was other reasons that I wrote about these things, but it didn't start as the idea didn't start as a full-fledged autobiography. It started as writing one article here about an incident or something I remembered, and it was published with pleasure by Haaretz literary editor. So he encouraged me to write on and on. And somehow, quite a number of papers, of pages in this of this autobiography accumulated, and I began thinking of making them into a book. And the publisher was very happy about it. Actually, they paid me before I finished writing, which doesn't happen to us in our profession. You know, it takes years after writing something that we ever, if at all, we get any pay for that. So the main thing is that Arabs among Jews, the idea of Arab among Jews living peacefully, generally speaking, living in not as enemies. Now the word Arab and Jew are to say Arab Jew is an oxymoron of sorts. I mean, how can you say he's black white? He's fat thin. I mean, this is the kind of thing you say, Arab Jews. It doesn't seem to be possible to this combination of words with a hyphen. So, but in my case, it did happen, and it's worth our while writing it down for posterity. Also, because, I mean, I'm not naive in saying that I'm going to introduce a new idea in the minds of the Middle Eastern Jews and Arabs, and to make peace between them and live like brothers. I'm not that naive. But I'm saying, by putting this on paper, I'm trying to say that it's possible, maybe difficult. I mean, Lenin would say the word difficult means that it's possible. And that's what I'm saying. It's possible. It's not impossible. It happened. Why shouldn't it happen again? So now I'm going to talk about specifically about the Jews of Iraq, who are the topic of my book. I'm not talking about myself. Actually, the Israeli ex-Israeli author Anton Shamas read the book when it came out. I sent him a copy. He lives in Ann Arbor, Michigan. He teaches there. And he wrote me a nice email. He said, it's a lovely book, well written, but you didn't open up. That's what his complaint was. You didn't open up. And I wrote him back. I said, I didn't intend to open up, and it wasn't a mistake that I am not opening. I didn't want to write about my problem. I mean, I'm not Freudian. You know, unless you say that you slept with your mother, it doesn't mean that it's not opening up. So I didn't want to talk about my compunctions, about my problems, about my psychological defects, etc. I talked about the community, as a member of the community, what I saw as a schoolboy, what I saw as a little child, what I witnessed during the difficult time that happened in 1941, what we call the Farhud, which I was going to say a few more words about. And that's one thing. The second thing, I wanted to deny the accusation that we are the Oriental Jews who came to Israel are religious communities par excellence, as opposed to the Ashkenazi, who can be either religious or secular. That's not, but you as an Oriental Jew from the Arab world, you're supposed to be somehow religious, pious, or believing in going to synagogue. I never saw a synagogue in my life, never, once. We went to a synagogue, it was because there was a family wedding taking place there. My father and my mother and my uncles and aunties, and nobody went to a synagogue in Baghdad. And this, I wanted to show it in action. And this was important for me because because at the time, and even now, unfortunately, we have some Iraqi religious leaders who came from Iraq, who were born in Iraq, but they were educated in Jerusalem. People like Rabbi Obadiah Yosef, who are ultra-Orthodox in the worst sense of the word, and they are very primitive religion, they're teaching very primitive religion, although he knows the Talmud by heart. They said there's nobody who knows so many texts by heart like Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, but he's instructing very primitive way of religion. He's causing these people who are voting for his party or going after him to lose touch with reality, with modernity, with everything that is we all treasure in our life. We want to be modern people. We want to be living in this world and not living in the world of our foreparents. So, what I the main gist of the book is to show that this was at least the middle class to whom I belong. My father was a bank employee. He graduated, and my mother too, from the Allianz High School, the Allianz schools system in Iraq, where they taught them French and English. And my mother read all the time in these two languages. So it's not exactly that we are hidden behind the volume of Talmud, all of us, and not aware of what's happening in the world. That's important to make point on this. For me, it was very important. And now, if you open that handout at the end, there are two pictures I want to talk about. One, unfortunately, didn't come out very clearly, but it's a beautiful picture. And the text that I have in green pages is analysis of this picture. You can read it later, but I'm going to do this in briefly, the analysis. This is a picture of a wedding that took place in 1927 in Baghdad. Now remember the date, it's important. 1927 is 10 years after the British took over Baghdad, and a year or two before Iraq became an independent state, modern, independent, secular state, supposedly, and everything. Not what you see today on TV every day. And the Jewish community was flourishing at the time. In the middle, of course, there is the bride and bridegroom. My uncle is the bride. His name is Ezra. And his wife is called Victoria, typically. I had three aunties who were called Victoria. They were all born around in the first decade of the 20th century, and Queen Victoria was the queen of the world at the time. So they're all called Victoria. And, all these Victorias are dead. If they were alive, they would be 120 years old now. Okay? She's Victoria. Now, let me talk about the social background. Victoria is the daughter of a big merchant, and he's sitting with a tarbush, with a fez, on the right side of the picture. That's her father. He was a rich person. He was a merchant and owned some land with the Shiite. His co-owners were Shiites. We used to go to that plantation that they had and spent weekends there. And my family of my father was a poorer family. They're all in the lower middle class. My grandfather was a clerk working with merchants. I mean, he wasn't a clerk of a bank. But my father and his two brothers, I'll show you these three people, but the bridegroom is not included. He and two of his brothers were bank clerks, and working in British banks. And that's it. Note the word British bank, British firm, British business, British in Baghdad. So they had to know English. My father had no recourse to his Arabic. He knew Arabic, but he didn't use it anywhere. I mean, his bank worked only in English, and his superiors were British who came to a bank. If you see, you see the book one day, you see the picture of his bank clerks with the three British managers here. Maybe you know them by any chance. David, you come from that part of the world. Okay. I'm joking, of course. They are dead and buried many, many years ago. Anyhow, so at that time, the class distinction was melting because the middle class was a lower middle class was totally separate from the higher class of merchants or rich merchants. They wouldn't talk to each other. They weren't on speaking terms. But because the middle class was acquiring European education, so many of these rich people were willing at long last to intermarry with the lower middle class. And this picture is a very good example of this whole process of change, the process of change, of modernization, of secularization. You will see about, I'll talk about secularization. Now, Dr. Marcus is an expert on Ottoman history. I'm saying that there's no sign of any kind of Ottomanism here, apart from the tarbush, from the face, which the father of the bride and the father of the bridegroom also. You can't see him very well. He's hidden between these two young men. You see him, he's wearing tarbush. That's my grandfather, whose name was Shmuel Somer. He was a poor one of among the fathers of the tarbush wearers. The one with the tarbush in the center, more central, is, as I said, is Bechor, the father of the bride. And her sisters and family, you can see, are next to the bridegroom, wearing the latest Paris fashion. It's not clear in this picture, but my picture in the book shows it very clearly. I'm sure that they went to Champs-Élysées and bought these hats for the occasion of the marriage of their sister. And also you see that others are wearing modern, I mean, apart from these three fat women on the left, who are still show signs of the late 19th century. But the rest are 20th century par excellence. And that's what, when my mother died and I discovered this picture in one of her drawers, I became enamored of it. I spent hours, days, just looking and trying to identify each one. Many of them are, no, I could tell who they are, but out of the 40 people here, I could identify about 30. I'll tell you who are people worth mentioning, as far as I'm concerned, from my viewpoint. My uncle is the bridegroom. My father is on the right side, but toward the end. You see he's wearing a bow tie. That's my father. He was not married at the time, but a year later he married my mother. My mother was born and grew up in the south of Iraq, in Basra, and she came to Baghdad to get married and stayed in Baghdad till the end, until we came here to Israel in 1951. Now, the two fidonneur, these are the two fidonneur. I couldn't write fidonneur in the English translation because I said boys of honor or children of honor. This is a French tradition of wedding. You have to have a fidonneur. Look at them wearing salesman's kind of dressing. The rest of the people are, they look very, very secular, very secular. And none of them looks as a person who goes to synagogue. And you have to know these people who went to synagogue. They still wore something on their heads. They still wore, they wouldn't wear ties or shoes like the way these people are dressed. Here's my other uncle is under the other pillar. Also, you can see the similarity, the resemblance with his other brothers. His name is Moshe. He died in Los Angeles about 30, 40 years ago. They came, settled in America after the Second World War. And his wife is next to him. She is also... This is another example of the intermarriage between the middle class graduate of Allianz School and the rich people. She is a daughter of a rich family. They are merchants also. Okay. There are more things to say. On the side, this is the house of the father of the bride. This is their house. I thought that at first when I wrote the book, I thought it was a corner in the synagogue, but it turns out that this is the private house of the family. And you see there's a pillow, a modern pillow in the forefront, and these things indicate something. There are three boys in the right side, on the extreme right on top. These are Muslims, probably assistants at home, like servants, like cleaners, etc., etc. They were asked, allowed to participate in the event, and this is the picture. I mean, this picture was to me an eye-opener. Suddenly I discovered what happened. In the 1927, this was the year, I would say, of the change that took place overwhelmingly, not just here and there, the beginnings of change, but this is the change itself. I mean, you don't see any presence of anything religious here, not a rabbi, not anything, a Jewish symbol, not a Sefer Torah or something. Of course, this is a photographer who was professional. He happens to be Armenian who came to Baghdad and set up a photography business, and he was the best photographer in Baghdad. And he asked them to look modern. I'm sure it helped, but I'm sure it's not the only reason that they look modern. On the other hand, I forgot to say that there are still... My grandmother, the mother of my father, is exactly in the center of the picture. She's wearing kind of something on her head, which is 19th century or 18th century type, not modern. And there are two other women behind her like that. So she refused to change, to acquire a modern look. She stayed in her original kind of traditional clothes, and that's my grandmother Masouda. And next to her, there's her daughter Victoria, so my uncle Ezra had a sister called Victoria and a wife called Victoria and another cousin called Victoria. If you know modern Hebrew literature, there is a novel called Victoria by Sami Michael, who is also tells the story of a woman of that generation. I mean, she was born in 1900 or so. It's available in English translation. It's a wonderful novel about this kind of leap forward into civilization from the old neighborhoods of Baghdad to the modern European architecture. Everything was European after that. So this picture was my documentation of my to what I wrote. I mean, I had my writing is itself a documentation. I'm not lying. I'm telling my story and my family's story, and etc. But this was a documentation. The second thing, if you turn the page, another photograph. This is even more so. But this is 22 years later, 1949. This is the finishing class of this high school Shamash of Baghdad. That's a school I went to. This is a class ahead of me, of mine. But most of the boys that were here, the boys, they look like men. They are my friends, including also the girls. First of all, the very fact that this is the only school probably in the whole entire Arab world that had boys and girls. And it wasn't as simple as the way I'm explaining it. I mean, it was a boys' school. But for the last two classes, the final classes, they would admit about 10 girls in each class, because there was no high school, finishing high school for girls. So they allowed them to come and study with us. They would sit in the front chairs of the class for, were allotted to them the four rows, beginning rows. And in the breaks between classes, they had a club of their own. They would sit there. They wouldn't mix with us. But the way they are portrayed in this picture, it's as if it's a natural by educational, how to say it, not by education, women and men in the same class. Let me tell you some other thing about it. Look at the men, how they are well dressed. The model is a British college, and this school indeed was set up by Iraqis who settled British and made good, and they sent money, plenty of money, to establish a school different from the Alliance school. The Alliance school was a French system, and the French was the main language. And in this case, they said, look, you are a part of the English-speaking world. This is Britain. Iraq is ruled by Britain at the time, and Britain is a leading force in the Middle East. International commerce was already made in English, not in French at that time. So they decided to have a school whereby the English language was the main language. And the teachers, the one who taught us English was Mr. Roger, who was imported from Britain. And the other topics like mathematics, physics, etc., were also taught in English, but by Iraqi Jews who went to Beirut, to the American University, and came back with knowledge, could teach in English. I mean, the instruction always went in English, although we could ask questions in Arabic. We all spoke Arabic as a daily language, but the official language of that school was English, apart from the topics in which Arabic and Arab history was a topic, and that was taught in Arabic. And of course, the language, Arabic language and grammar, and you know that Arabic language is a very sophisticated, you have to learn Arabic from the beginning, from ABC, because the system of speaking and writing are two different languages. So we had teachers who taught us Arabic. They're mostly Shia communists, and I'll show you one of them. The third one to the left is someone called Hussein Mrua. I'll tell you who he is. He's a very important person. He taught us Arabic. He was my first teacher of Arabic literature. He is a Shiite who was sent by his parents when I was 14 to Najaf, the holy city of the Shia, of which we now know something. Everyone who watches TV knows about Najaf. He was sent there to study, but he was lost his religion in the case of the course of his studies, and he became a communist, not just a communist, but a leading communist. And for some reason, he landed in our school. He was the main teacher of Arabic, and not only that, but this is a Jewish school, and he brought his son Nizar, who is also sitting in their teacher's row. He's a schoolboy. He was a member of this class. His name is Nizar Marua, the second to the right. Nizar and his father were thrown out of Iraq in 1950, I think. They went back to Beirut. And Semua became the ideological leader of the Lebanese Communist Party. He was sent to Moscow to do a PhD on the topic of which is the Marxist approach to the history of Arabic literature, and he published that in two volumes. I always dreamt of having some time to write about these books, but so far I haven't been able to, because he's my teacher, because he gave me so much in way of thinking differently about literature, not the traditional way, learned by heart, and etc. He was a different kind of teacher. The other teacher I would like to mention here is in the center. He's Meir Haya, the headmaster. He taught mathematics. He was a very good teacher, and with all of us, he settled in Israel in 1951 because he didn't know. None of them us knew Hebrew, so he had to teach in Arab schools. So he ended his life as a teacher of mathematics in Nazareth, in the Arab city in the Galilee. And people remember him now. He was a master teacher. He was a great teacher. I think he also finished his schooling at the American University in Beirut. I could mention others, but I think that's enough. Look at the girls. They were dressed not as the Muslim women today dress. They're normal. You could find them in Paris, in London, in Rome, or even right, Annalisa? Okay. All right. And so this was the generation I grew up with. These were my friends. Many of them were playmates with me in the school, and after that, I met them even in Israel after we all emigrated, the whole community of 120,000 communities. So these were the friends I befriended in Israel too. So these are the two pictures I wanted to show you. There are other photographs in the book, but I, since I'm talking about modernization, I wanted to show you documentation of this. What is the meaning of modernization to me? All these students in the school became very successful. I tell you, I know, I'm seeing here in this picture at least two regional courts judges in Israel. Now, one very, very important, very rich lawyer, two professors in the Technion, the technical, the MIT of Israel, and etc., etc. This is a special generation. I mean, they came to Israel 17 or 18 years old. They were 1 year older than me. I arrived at the age of 17, fully ready to take over with and the administration in Israel in 1951 was basically British. It hasn't changed. The British were the rulers of Palestine, handed over the offices and the systems and the terminologies they used were English. And these people took over. They were right away, they're ready for that, which unfortunately didn't work with the Moroccan Jews, the Jews of North Africa. They came from French system, and nothing worked for them in Israel. It was something else. For example, a lawyer who finished his legal training in Baghdad didn't have to do any additional studying, because this was both places worked on the British system, the courts, etc., etc. My father was a department head for, I think, one of the departments of the bank, and he was able to work right away. As soon as he arrived, didn't know a word of Hebrew, and that was a problem, not the profession, because he continued to do what he was doing in Baghdad, exactly in the same Baghdad, but he couldn't communicate with his superiors and with his assistants, and he couldn't speak Hebrew. He died 5 years after our arrival, very young, and having this feeling that he is a kind of outsider. He'll never be a member of this society, a full-fledged member. Sometimes I say these Oriental Jews were suffering, weren't treated well. I agree. But in the case of my father, I can put it differently completely. He was very well treated and given a good job at the time. As a newcomer, he just arrived. 3 months later, 4 months later, he got his job. But, you know, the problem is not because someone was not giving him equality or anything like that, but because of the problem of immigration, one of these problems, you don't know the language. And that's the story of these two pictures. I wanted, I also talked about the situation of Jews among others. For example, I was 7 years old when the Farhud occurred. Now, to those who don't know what Farhud is, this is a disturbance that occurred under the Nazi propaganda in 1941, in which the poor areas where the Jews lived, not the rich ones, were attacked by marauders, by soldiers who ran from the army, and by Bedouins, and they were attacked and killed. 150 of them were killed, and women were raped. It was a horrible thing. Never, the Jews of Baghdad never witnessed this kind of situation. Suddenly, out of the blue, or I should say not out of the blue, because the Nazi propaganda was rampant before that. For a year or so, there was a Arabic radio broadcasting from Berlin all the time talking about the Jews of the Arab lands robbing their neighbors, etc., etc. And in the end, some young officers in the army, the Iraqi army, who hated Britain, decided to link up with the Nazis, if possible. It didn't work out because the Germans weren't anywhere nearby. But they were able to take over the government through a coup, and for a few months, 3 months, rule Iraq. Then the British came back, and they ran away, all of them, leaving Baghdad without any government, without any responsible person. And during that day of no government, these events happened. Now, people call these events pogrom. I don't agree to that. I was talking to my Talit. Pogrom has a special meaning in the Christian context. I mean, they attack the Jews because they killed their God, not because they are richer or you envy them or hate them because they are setting up their own state. That's not pogrom. Pogrom is something else. So I don't like this appellation, this term used in this context. Definitely it was a horrible, horrible event for the Jewish. It was a traumatic. But people who, modern historians, say the history of the Iraqi Jews of 2,500 years ended with this program. I don't agree with that. For two reasons. One, after 41, this was the best time in the history of Iraqi Jews. There was a prosperity because the army of the Britain and American and Australians were in Iraq, and they had to be served, and who else but the Jews would serve them? And they became rich. I mean, hundreds of Jews built mansions during that period before 1948, which is the other end of the 10 years of since the Farhud. They left Iraq in 1951. So during these years were the best years for as far as the Jews of Iraq were concerned. They were happy, they were well settled, all their partnerships with Muslims were working very well, and their neighbors and the Jews and Muslims were good neighbors at the time. Until 1948, the 47-8, the partition of Palestine and the Palestine War, change the situation. So I'm not saying that the Farhud 1941 passed and was forgotten. I'm sure there was somewhere it left some, you know, injuries in the which were called to action in 1948 when the atmosphere between Muslims and Jews was worsened again because of the war in Palestine. And the second reason that this thing didn't happen because of 1941. I'm not saying that those who had their brothers, sisters, fathers, mothers killed would forget it so easily. But the majority, the bulk of the community forgot these events very quickly because they're busy making money, and not only making money. I'm not saying that the Jews only want to make money, but they were happy. They were they felt prosperous. They felt good. Nobody was scheming against them. They didn't feel that they had any problem with the world. And suddenly, overnight, the United Nations decision changes the situation. So the second reason is that we forget that although 150 Jews were killed, at least 200 Muslims were killed in the same disturbances. And most of these 200, because they wanted to defend their Jewish neighbors. And this should be really written in letters of fire, you know, huge letters. Thank you very much, Ben. This is a great thing to tell the story of Jewish-Muslim neighborhood. I'm not saying brotherhood. But to say that 100, 120, 150, we don't know exactly how many, there was a committee that was appointed by the pro-British government to investigate these events. And it turns out that not only Jews were killed, but Muslims were killed by the marauders because they wanted to defend their Jewish neighbors. And this is a Muslim tradition. I mean, they claim that this is a typical Arab thing to take hostages when someone is being attacked, and you have to give him, if you are his neighbor, you have to be his responsible for his life too. And this is happened in this event more than we think it did, more than we talk about it. And this is the worst part of the story. To make the Farhud, with all its ugliness and hatred, to forget this part of it is a crime. Because then they say, all the Muslims want to kill the Jews, so that's all. And you forget that this is not the whole story. Stories are always more complex, always more complex. Okay, this is the second topic I wanted to speak about. 5 more minutes, okay? The third thing is the Arabization of the Jews. I was talking about Europeanization, which is true. I mean, I showed you how Europeanized they were, the middle class. The richer ones, they were different story. And the poor, they still were beginning to go to school, to good schools, and to study foreign languages, etc. Now, on the other hand, what happened during the 1920s and 30s and 40s? It's only 30 years, 35, 40 years of history that I'm talking about. That the Jews of Iraq, and probably other Arab regions too, but I'm talking about my community, was totally Arabized during these 40 years. I think Lital tomorrow tells us more about it. Because until then, until the turn of the century, say 1900, not exactly, but this is a convenient number, 1900, the Jews didn't use Arabic, written Arabic, as the language of communication, of letters, but they spoke Arabic, true. And the Arabic of the Jews of Baghdad wasn't identical with the Arabic of the Muslims of Baghdad. These were two completely separate dialects, completely, totally. There's no connection between them. Unbelievable, but this is a very phenomenon that was investigated later on by one of my professors in Israel, and the problem was solved by him. Anyhow, the Jews didn't learn to write Arabic. They learned they wrote their letters and their books. Books in the business books, like accounts, in Judeo-Arabic, in Arabic, but with Hebrew letters, Hebrew characters. And as of 1900, they started learning Arabic, not Jewish Arabic. And so much so that some of them became leaders in the field of Arabic literature in Iraq in the 1920s and 1930s. Not a few. I mean, one of them set up the best literary journal in Iraq that Muslims and Jews wrote, published their articles in it. And Orit, who's sitting in the corner there, knows these people very well. She wrote about one of these journals that was Arabic journals established by a Jew. And this was a strange thing, because until 10, 20 years earlier, they didn't even read that language. They didn't know. A few would, but the average Jewish boy wouldn't learn to read Arabic. He wouldn't. He would go to Beit Midrash, a Jewish school, and study the Hebrew, and because he knows the letters in Hebrew, he could write his Arabic in these letters. But in the course of this 1920s, 30s, a whole generation of Arab Jews came to the fore, real Arab Jews who were educated. They mastered the Arabic heritage of Jahiliyyah and this Muslim period with the great poets and the great writers, and they were very proud of them. I and my friends in school would compete by who knows more of these poems by heart. These poems were with rhyme and rhythm and very, very strong. You learned it by heart, the whole poem. It was a monorhyme, 50 lines of poetry with the same rhyme. And we learned them by heart. And we looked at ourselves as 100% Arabs, not only because we spoke Arabic, but because our culture, which we are proud of. I had known nothing about Hebrew culture, nothing, believe me. I didn't know the name Yehuda Levi, for example, the great poet of Muslim Spain, wrote in Hebrew. I didn't know his name until I arrived in Israel. So this is important to say, and I'm showing it how at the age of 16 I began to see myself as a poet in Arabic literature, and I wrote and published poems and literary criticism when I was a high school boy, and published them in journals in Baghdad already before coming to Israel. And this is also a part of my intention to show how different this community and these communities are from what the Israelis imagine them to be. They imagine them to be backward communities who were persecuted by their Muslim neighbors, who didn't know anything about Europe, and we, as long as they came to us and we teach them now what is Europe. In fact, the other way around. When we came to Israel, the best translators between English and Arabic were Iraqi Jews who arrived just now, because they didn't know Hebrew, but so they were translators, and the doctors who graduated from medical doctors who graduated from medical school of Baghdad, which was a very good school, engineers. And were very much in demand because they came with a good knowledge of their profession. They were very successful. Those who came with a professional study, graduates of professional schools, were a great success in Israel. And in Iraqis, I went to an Iraqi doctor. I mean, in Israel, you call a Jew from Iraq an Iraqi. And that's one of the things that I'm going to finish with this anecdote. When I wrote it in the book, when we arrived in Israel, the dichotomy that we had in the past in Baghdad was you are either Jewish or Muslim, or non-Jewish, okay? So when you ask, you say, you wanted to know if your friend you were talking about, who is an Iraqi Jew, said, is he Jewish? Okay? Because otherwise he would be Muslim, Iraqi Muslim. When we arrived in Israel, this habit persisted. And for years, we made this mistake. And for example, his daughter married a person by the name of Moshe. Is he Jewish? In Israel, everyone is Jewish. But is he an Iraqi Jew? And that's a story I told in this, it happened to us. We caught ourselves saying, no, I mean Iraqi Jew. Is he Iraqi Jew? This thing I'd end my talk, and thank you for coming here. I wanted to tell you some secrets of a book in the making, but I'll do that maybe tomorrow we'll find an opportunity. The second volume of my autobiography, which is underway. I only have 3 more chapters to write, and the book will go to the printer. Okay.
Thank you very much, Hasan. I think we have time for a couple of questions before we have to go off. But please don't go away from the podium, Hasan. We may have time for a couple of questions, so you should stay here in case we have them, and you can answer them. Do I see Alison waving her hand in a preliminary way?
No.
Oh, I see. Well, in that case.
Oh, can you try hard?
I'm curious, when you keep talking about how modern Iraqi Jews are, you seem to use modern as a synonym for European, and I'm just wondering, is there some other way to be modern besides being European and being an Iraqi Jew?
Yeah. First, let me correct myself. I didn't say that the Iraqi Jews were modern. I was saying that one group among them, say 20% of them, were 100% modern. They followed in everything, the way you are putting it, European ways. They're trying to imitate Europe, if you wish. They speak, use foreign languages. For example, my family used to correspond between Basra and Baghdad in English, because my mother never learned written Arabic. She knew English and French. And so all the correspondence in my family in Iraq was in English. So this you might call imitation. It's not a true development into a modern person. But what other example can you follow? There's no other thing. This is the whole thing was brought by the British. A part of the secularity acquired by many Iraqis or middle class, because they worked with British. They were the only, and the reason is very simple. They're the only ones who knew English and French. So the British employed them all over, in everything. And they set up a whole government with ministries, and all the many directors of the ministries. The supreme boss was a British officer, but number two would be a Jew, who spoke both English and Arabic, and could write both English and Arabic. Some of them, even before that, I discovered. Not I, Eli Kaduri is a professor in a British school, professor of history. He discovered a document of a Jew by the name of Shohet, who wrote in 1911. He worked as a translator in the British council in Baghdad or in Basra, and he was asked to prepare a report about the Jews of Iraq, and he wrote a lovely document. Everyone, have you seen it? It's a lovely document.
Baghdad in
1911. I translated it in my book, because it was, first of all, he explained how many rich, how many poor, how many educated, and it was more or less accurate. It made sense. And the second thing, the English was amazingly good, amazingly idiomatic. It was someone who knew very English, and that was in before the British entered Iraq. They were working for the council, federal representative in Baghdad. There's nobody else to copy but Europe. America didn't exist. If you are jealous about this because you are American, no, I don't. I don't think there was a way of imitating anyone else. There is one more element which I didn't go into now. That was the Far East. Many of the Jews of Iraq, not millions, by the thousands probably, settled in Asia, in India, Malaya, in Singapore, in Indochina, and flourished there, And but they wouldn't imitate the culture of the Asians. I mean, what else can you do? But culture is imitation. I mean, it doesn't come out of the trees or of the air. It's an imitation, always, from one culture to another. The difference between the Arabs and the Far East people is that the Far Eastern admit that they copy, whereas the Arabs say, no, everything is our original making. I remember we went to Japan several years ago, and we went to a factory, to a weaving, museum of weaving. And in every place said, we learned this technique from these Vietnamese neighbors, and it was developed in China. We brought it from this. I said to Terry, now I understand something very important. The Arabs will never, never, never admit they copied something. And everything good about the Arab culture, medieval Arab civilization, which was a fantastic civilization, I mean, when it comes to sciences and knowledge and philosophy and everything, it was all started by imitation. There's nothing but imitation. So you're looking for something which I don't know if it ever exists, that one can develop a kind of civilizational attitude by going to school and learning about ancient civilizations, and instead of copying what you have seen within the British occupiers of Iraq, that you copy from ancient utopias. That doesn't exist.
Oh, you can interject.
Just a quick little sociological question on the picture you have of a school. I noticed that the men, except for one Maurice and one Jack, all of them have good Hebrew or Arabic names. Whereas the women, they are Evelyn and Bertha.
That's a very good question. A lovely question.
And Doris, but they have many more European names for the women.
Yeah. That's true. I have a chapter in my book about the names, naming names. It starts with my name. I'm Sasson, not Sasson. I'm Sasson, my first name is Sasson. And I was surprised to discover that this is a very, very popular name among my generation, the Iraqi Jews. And the other two popular names are not Avraham, Yaakov, Moshe, but Ezra and Yechezkel. Now, Ezra and Yechezkel, it's clear why these are the prophets who were born or were buried near Baghdad. And these are the local prophets of the Old Testament. But why Sasson? Sasson is not a biblical name in the first place. I didn't understand. I still haven't been able to solve this riddle. It's a riddle. Why? Why Sasson?
Said?
No. Said is something else. It came with the modernization, with the Arabization. I'll talk about it. I'm going to answer your question. It's more complicated than that. It's true that in this community and other Jewish communities, even in Europe, the first to acquire foreign names, Christian names in the case of Europe, are women. And because a person doesn't want to give his sons foreign names because he has to see... this is a kind of obligation towards his religion and his tradition. It's very difficult to... deviate from the giving Jewish names. But women were given foreign names. Now, what names? You said it yourself. They're all from the Allianz schools. I mentioned in my book that the two popular names are the two names of the heroines of Proust's novel in research of the lost time. I don't remember the name, but these are the two. I said maybe one of the teachers in the Allianz was crazy about Proust. I mean, jokingly. But that's true. But it didn't come from the Muslim names. Whereas men, you are right. Said is one of these. These are Arabic names that the fathers gave to their children so that they won't be too transparent as Jews. If I'm called Sasson, everyone knows that I'm Jewish. If I'm called the Haskell, I'm Jewish. But if I'm called Said, nobody can tell what if I'm Jewish or not. And my class, let me see, my class was composed, the men in my generation were one-third Jewish. And the reason that I stayed Jewish is very simple. I'm called Sasson because my grandfather was Sasson Somer, and he was executed by the Turks in 1916. And the whole family, whenever a boy was born, they called him Sasson. So there are about 15 Sasson Somer in the world, including a cousin who lives now in San Francisco, let's say. His name is Sasson Somer. About 7 or 8 of these changed their names when they came to Israel to Dan. I don't know why, but this happened. Dan, for no reason, I don't know, but they didn't arrange it between them. It so happened that they were all called Dan. So the reason that there are one-third Jewish names is because you have to call your son after your father. So there are all kinds of traditions on that. The other third is Richard, Victor, very, very common name, Victor. Who else? Well, they're all called like that. Who?
Albert,
yes, French and English. And in the 1940s, something very interesting happened. That boys and girls with the French name started pronouncing their names in the English way. For example, my auntie Rachel. Rachel was a very, very, very common name. The most common, I think, in those who were born in the 1920s and 30s. Rachel. But in the 1950s, they started saying Rachel. To anglicize and the same thing Victor and Victor and things like that. They just changed the stress, less of the stress of the name. You are right. I mean, this story, the study of names of people is a very important thing to ascertain the cultural history of this community. Where are the trends? So the last third, I said, one-third Hebrew Jewish names, all Jewish names. The second is European names, French and English. I would say that it constitutes 50% of my generation. And the third is Arabic names. Of course, you can't call a Jew by the name of Muhammad or Hassan or Hussein. These are the religious names. Nobody would use them. But names are like Jamil, like Kamal, especially names of ministers in the last Ottoman governments. Anwar, Enver became Anwar, of course. And who else? All these names of ministers in the Sultan's vicinity. What other names? Like many. No, Salim, Uncle Salim. Salim is a very common name because it's neither Muslim, it has nothing Muslim in it. It means that you are okay, you are perfect, you are healthy, or something, anything like that. That's what it means. It's not a traditional Muslim name. That's it. But it's not a... Yeah, of course, a Sultan Salim. I forgot. This Salim comes from a Sultan, not even a minister in the government. What? Murad, very common, yes. Also the Murad. But the ministers, the members of the Turkish Young Turks, all these names were very common among Jews because they welcomed the Ottoman Revolution. They were some ex-Jews among the members of this revolution, right? Of the perpetrators. Okay. One more question.
I think that we should draw to the door to close for now. We can have more questions tomorrow. And we should thank Sasson once again for...